Blog Talk Radio.
You're now listening to the Talking Pictures Podcast, broadcasting from sunny Orange County, California. Filmmaker, journalist, and film historian, Paul Booth.
Aloha, welcome to Talking Pictures. Thank you for joining me today. This is a special episode because we're going to be talking about the great, unfortunately late, Haskell Wexler, ASC. That stands for American Society of Cinematographers, for those of you that go to the movies and always wonder why a lot of the cinematographers have those letters next to their name. Again, this show is ours. It's not put on or sponsored by the ASC. But today we're going to be joined by the president who knew Haskell Wexler. Haskell Wexler was known for films like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Bound for Glory, The Woody Guthrie Pick, and I call it elusive because I can't find it anywhere on the planet just because of what it says about the times, Medium Cool. A lot of people tell me it's to try Criterion, but had to do with the 1968 Democratic National Convention. Wexler was also Coming Home, the first film to really deal with veterans coming home. That was another thing that he was part of with Hal Ashby, Jane Fonda, John Voight. Not one to veer away from controversy. One to just do his thing and stick to his vision. And that's what I admired about him. This is the one time where I will take a sec to talk about myself before Richard Crudo calls in. When I saw Coming Home, it made me want to help veterans. And that was 17 years ago. And I ended up being able to do something to help veterans. And then I started to realize and go back after he passed that his influence on my work is in everything. The sticking to your guns, the putting your vision out there and putting your best foot forward. All of those things, especially the just not caring what people think of your vision. That it's your vision and it's yours to have is a big one. And Coming Home is just an incredible film. That's a film of his I own. I frequently go back to it for inspiration. I mean, it's not the most upbeat movie. When you're looking at something about the way our veterans were treated when they came home from Vietnam, which wasn't good, then it's not really going to be upbeat. But, you know, for the most part, it did capture the generation, the times. That's why people got so upset with Jane Fonda. Of course, she won an Oscar. John Voight won an Oscar. It was directed by the great Hal Ashby, who is also another director who I found through studying Haskell Wexler and his films and trying to find out who directed them because he's the cameraman and came across Hal Ashby. And once you've kind of gone through their films, then you kind of just get lost in the 70s films. You kind of just get addicted to them and you want to see these guys who are just putting themselves out and not really answering to or caring what the budget was or the box office or the doing it for Oscars or any of that stuff. So that is what I, you know, really, really admire about Haskell Wexler, because he was just straightforward about it. Again, I'm not the biggest guy on talking about myself, but I had the good fortune to call him or to meet him, and I saw him walking towards me, and I thought, oh, you know, I gotta stop him. He was in his 92 or 93, I believe. And I thought, you know, I don't like to do this, but I'm going to interrupt this gentleman's time. And it was an open house, so it wasn't really like interrupting his time like he's eating dinner at a restaurant. Sorry, had to drink my water there. Like I said, this is coffee shop atmosphere. We always invite our guests to also have a drink with them, because you get dry throat talking for how long we sometimes talk on this show. I know that was kind of redundant. I'm so sorry. My apologies. Okay, we have Richard Crudo calling in. I will bring him in now. Aloha, Richard. How are you doing?
Aloha, Paul. How are you? I'm doing great.
I'm fantastic. Fantastic this morning.
What's going on out there?
Pardon?
What's going on out there?
Oh, nothing. Beautiful blue skies, sitting here with the studio, and very, very excited to talk about Haskell Wexler. He was such a major influence to me, and I know you knew him many years, so I'm interested to hear what you have to say.
Well, you know, Haskell was one of the giants, and I don't use that term loosely. He was really a unique individual as a man, but in terms of cinematography, he's part of that generation that literally changed the way movies looked in the late 60s and the 1970s, what a lot of people like to refer to as the last golden age of cinema in the United States, of mainstream movie making. And Haskell was a huge part of that. An incredible vision, an incredibly talented guy, and a really interesting individual. He had a lot of outside interests. Obviously, his documentary career, he probably made 50 documentaries in his time, and he was working right up until the time he passed. He had three or four things going on that I know he was very interested in, and I always looked at him as something of a hero.
That's interesting, because I really liked that, because when I met him, he seemed like a guy who, and I believe he was 92 last year or something, and he really did feel like an artist who was like just fresh out of film school waiting for the next, you know, thing to whet his appetite. And I thought that was really interesting. It wasn't like, oh, I'm an
that's
old
really,
man. Go ahead.
No, that's really true. That's very true. He had an incredible life force. And I always used to say to him, Haskell, you are my role model. And should I be so lucky to live as long, I want to be exactly like you. Steve Pizzello, who's the editor of American Cinematographer magazine, I think he put it best. I wish I thought of this, but the line is absolutely true. He said when he heard that Haskell passed away, he had never in his life been so surprised to hear that a 93-year-old died. And I felt exactly the same way. Haskell was one of those guys you thought would just go on forever. And he was vital and involved and passionate right up until the end. And that was just amazing. One of the amazing things about him.
Right. To give people a context that don't know some of his harder to find films, before you called in, I was talking about Medium Cool, which I'm still trying to find. I think it's somewhere in a box in Utah. Bound for Glory, you know, Gritty Guthrie, and of course Coming Home, and Richard Pryor Live on the Sunset Strip. I mean, and Once Over the Cuckoo's Nest, like you were saying, these are like landmark pieces of cinema. These are like things, like you're saying, that did change the way we looked at things, the way we looked at cinema, even the way we looked at ourselves. Would you say that was like Hasco's mission?
Oh, sure. Even going back earlier than that, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf?
Oh, yes.
That's really the film that brought him to prominence in the mid-60s. And if you look at that film, there was nothing like it. Nothing looked like that in mainstream American movie making prior to that film. It was a feature film with the biggest stars of the day, Richard Burton, Elizabeth Taylor, young George Segal, Sandy Dennis, who was on the rise. And in the traditional studio model, always had, you know, a very prominent, bright key light and fill light, and they were very hard, contrasty in a sometimes not very pleasing way, colorful, the color films. They were still very studio bound and very stodgy in their photography. This film basically threw the rule book out the window. It did not go for that gloss, that veneer, that glamour. It was very gritty, very edgy, very dark, a lot of texture in the black and white, in a way totally unlike, took a lot of grief for that. I mean, the mainstream cameramen of the day really looked down on it. They didn't think that that was the way you should be shooting major movie stars in feature films, studio productions. And he was definitely ahead of his time with that. And then we look at it now, and it's not so shocking because we're very used to that look now. It's been mainstreamed in a lot of ways. But at that time, it was really a departure from the norm.
Right. And of course, that was one that was one of his first Oscars. He got one for Bound for Glory as well. And also two other films that would be for our mainstream listeners would be In the Heat of the Night and The Thomas Crown Affair. And please don't say don't think the Pierce Brosnan version, the Steve McQueen version. But about, not you,
exactly.
I mean, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? Honestly, Richard, what's kind of funny about that film is the way you were saying his lighting and textures changed, is that that is a very heavy duty movie content wise. That,
well, it's tough to watch.
It's a tough movie material.
Yeah, in terms of the play, the drama, it's tough to watch. It's people eviscerating each other. And the thing is, the photography serves that mood. It serves the intent of the story, which is the greatest thing you can say about cinematography, that it bolsters, it buoys up the underlying themes and the story itself. Hopefully you don't want it to be too noticeable to walk out of the theater humming the photography, but at its best, it will serve the story in the way that it did in terms of what Haskell did on Virginia Woolf.
Yeah, you know, that film, and there's just one other film, and of course we won't discuss them or anything, but the first time I ever really was conscious, I was only like 16 or 17, of the camera really serving the story, was Roger Deakins with Shawshank Redemption, to where the cinematography always met the mood of each scene. When it was the happy time, was, you know, I wouldn't know the technical terms of what he was lighting up or not, or... And when it was in the prison, we're in a prison. So, but back to Mr. Wexler, is there any particular story you would like to share with us?
Well, Haskell and I, we used to get into it a lot about, Haskell had a lot of interests, as I say, politics was one of them. And we'd get into it about politics all the time. We had, I would say, pretty divergent points of view on a lot of issues. However, as passionate as we would both be in the argument, the discussion, the heated discussion, we would always end friendly. And Haskell would always say, you know, Richard, that's what makes this country great, that we can disagree about this and we can talk like gentlemen and argue, and at the end of it, shake hands and smile and still be friends. And that always impressed me about Haskell. He had a big heart underneath what I think might have seemed a bit of a gruff exterior. Haskell did not, he didn't suffer fools, let's put it that way. And I saw a lot of myself in him as well, just personally. You know, I admired him so much, and I really, along with quite a few other ASC members who have left us in the last 10 years, I miss them desperately. That was the generation that inspired us all to be cinematographers, my generation, in fact.
Oh, yes, we have to give appreciation for Vilmos Zsigmond.
Oh, of course. Vilmos was in the same class, I mean, just in the last 10 years, we've lost Conrad Hall, Richard Moore, Laszlo, Vilmos, Haskell, Gordon Willis, John Alonzo. If you go through that list and just review their resumes, that's almost the whole of the 1970s right there. One after the other, incredible films and incredible cinematography. And, you know, the generations are now, it's turning. We're all moving up a notch, so to speak. And those guys that I idolized and my contemporaries idolized, they're starting to pass away. There's only a couple left. Owen Roisman, who I'm having lunch with today, actually. Victor is still with us, thank goodness. And Bill Butler. Bill Butler also had an amazing career. Bill is up in his 90s, but he's still on the scene. And I hope these guys stay around for another 50 years. But, you know, life doesn't work like that, unfortunately.
They're all, what you just said, is pretty much, in my opinion, 1969 to like 1981 is like every movie
that's
made.
It.
You know, that's what I'm.
That's it. That was the era.
Yeah, that's the best era. Yeah. There's studio head. I had said that before you came on. I said, we're going to talk about a guy who was able to really excel at a time where it wasn't about the budget. Everybody wasn't trying to win an Oscar. Everybody wasn't trying to get in magazines. It was just making movies. And I had kind of told them about when I met Mr. Wexler at the clubhouse. And like you say, giant, I remember thinking when he was walking towards me, I had about 10 seconds to decide whether or not I had the, you know, the talk to him, because it was like a giant was walking towards you. And then just something said to me, this guy will be approachable, you know?
Oh, yeah. You know, they had at that time also, they had something that was very much in their favor, and that is that, you know, feature films were, they occupied a much more significant position in society at that time. You know, people today, there are so many things that vie for people's attention today. You know, video games, sports, everybody has a big screen, high definition television. Just life, the pace of everything is so accelerated today, and there's so many things pulling at them for their attention. That wasn't quite the case back in the late 60s and through the 70s. Life had a lot slower pace. You only had six channels on your television set. In many markets, the TV local channels stopped broadcasting after midnight, and everyone went to the movies and saw the same films. You know, movies played to bigger audiences in singleplex theaters on bigger screens, and it was much more of a shared communal experience. So movies had a much more significant role in people's lives at that time. I don't think we're ever going to see the likes of that period again, at least in feature film as we know it now. You know, we have event films, we have tent poles, and that's about it. There's no comparing, let's say, a Star Wars to a Five Easy Pieces or
Five Easy Pieces,
you know, or any of those films, you know, that were about people and about slice of life and odd situations, and that they would draw you in. They weren't flashy, they weren't big, they weren't action oriented, although there were plenty of action films at that time. You also had this other segment that was much more human and much more relatable and much, much more interesting than I think any action film you could name. And that is sort of that not even sort of, that has completely been obliterated from our society. You know, you've got the independent world, but the independents don't get the distribution. I mean, these were films that were being made by mainstream movie studios that were presented to people with major movie stars, and these were the big releases of the year at the time. If you walked into a studio executive's office today and, say, proposed a movie like Taxi Driver, I want to make a movie about a mentally deranged guy who drives a cab and is obsessed with a 12-year-old prostitute, they throw you out onto Melrose Avenue quicker than you could say go. But yet, that movie was made by Martin Scorsese, by a major studio, starring one of the biggest movie stars of the day. And it was a hit, and it was talked about. There's nothing like that. That would be an independent film today made for $1 million that 11 people would see.
Right. Well, what's interesting was I discovered all of this in like the same 2-week period, because I read this book that I always recommend, Easy Rider's Raging Bulls. And I started just writing down every film. So when people talk to me about The Last Picture Show or Five Easy Pieces or Bert Schneider or Dog Day Afternoon or Haskell Wexler, The Graduate, I got all this in a 14-day period. So it really was a movie. I think of that scene when Jack Nicholson, when they put the wires on his head, it was like, I was never the same person. There was like no turning back from seeing those films.
Yes. Well, I was very fortunate to have been a teenager during that period and just starting to become aware, not in the sense I couldn't have told you what a cinematographer did from The Man in the Moon at that time, but like all kids, we like to go to the movies. And, you know, we had the very good fortune, my generation, to have been exposed to that in a very formative time in our lives, you know. I mean, it's a good fortune on one level because it was great to see those movies and let them become part of your life at that time. However, also now you can look back wistfully and say, well, boy, that was great. And it's just not that good now. It hasn't been that good since. When I ask those guys, those cinematographers who shot those films, I would always ask them, what was it like while you were doing it? What was it like for you? They said, you know, we were in the middle of it, and we were just going to work, just making movies. We never thought it was any golden age or anything like that. We were just doing our thing. And that's really funny, because in retrospect, God, what a special period.
Oh, no, totally. That, I mean, like what you were saying, when I spoke with Mr. Wexler and told him that I did something because of Coming Home, and then it got like government officials mad at me, like he got a real big kick out of that. You know, it was like,
yeah, oh yeah,
he like loved that. He was like, that's what Hal and I wanted to do. We wanted like younger generations to think and to possibly find something for themselves, not necessarily with a movie, but just to come into your own. And so that was just a really special experience. And so I can see now what you're saying about him. I couldn't have imagined to have known him for years and years and years, because I'm still excited now, and it was a 5-minute talk.
Yes. Well, that's, you know, Haskell's not alone in that effect. All of those guys had a real charisma and kind of a glow around them, I think, that was bestowed upon them by having been part of those movies. You know, I mean, there are only a few of them that you can look at as real watermark films, let's say. I think that Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid in 1969, that was Conrad Hall's work. I think that that was an absolute marker in which you can say no movie has ever looked like this before. Movies started to change and the look started to come more into that ethic. Then The Godfather, Gordon Willis in 1972, no movie had ever looked like that before, and that spawned a look that everything that we see today is somehow traceable back to that. And then Haskell with Virginia Woolf in 66 on another level, three very distinct and very groundbreaking, seminal films in terms of cinematography and the way movies look. You can look back in time and you will never find another example like any one of those films until those films came along. And then that they were the catalyst that began to bring everyone else in the fold. They sort of redefined the boundary and showed what you could do, and everybody took the ball and ran with it from there.
Oh, yes. I mean, when those classic movie nights run The Godfather on the big screen, I think I've seen it like 5 times on the big screen. There's something just 10 times.
Oh, magical.
Yeah, it's magical. It's like there's something else. I remember for me, the first time I ever thought something else was going on besides, for some reason, you just thought movies appeared out of nowhere, was Dog Day Afternoon. So
yeah, I was, Victor Kemper's work.
Yeah. And I think that was the first time I was like, you know, this has to be set up. There's no way that I'm seeing something just this good. And so all those films, I'm glad that we're talking about them, because I get people who, you know, like I was saying, The Thomas Crown Affair, they think it's a Pierce Brosnan movie. And you hear that, and it's not to be condescending. It's not being film snobs. We're not saying anything like that. And so I'm glad that you talked about that golden age and that time when things change. Because like you said, now you see shadows in a comic book movie, and it's really Gordon Willis's work, or now even a computer, no disrespect to the effects people. And you're kind of, is there anything you could briefly say on that kind of up and down between what's on the computer and what's on the cinematographer? I mean, that's kind of an interesting...
Well, you know, that's a tough topic. It's a really tough topic, and we talk about it a lot at the ASC, and I know that the Motion Picture Academy is looking to us for some guidance on the issue. It's something that's not going to go away, and it's something that we're going to have to reckon with. The problem is this. Even on films that don't, on the surface, seem to be effects films, they all have a lot of special effects in them today. And even if it's just, changing the environment, removing a car or fixing a storefront or anything like that, and in period films it becomes even more so, and it's so good, the work is so good that it's invisible. You don't even know. You say, oh, they dressed that street that way and they shot it. Well, where do you draw the line if you're thinking about awards, let's say? Where do you draw the line in determining what was live-action photography and what was special effects work? It's essentially impossible to determine. You're never going to get a fair accounting from a studio or a visual effects house or a visual effects supervisor. Where do you draw the line, though? At 51-49% live versus effects, 60-40. I defy anyone to be able to discern well enough to make that call. Yet these hybrid films, Gravity, Life of Pi, Avatar, Avatar to a certain extent is a little bit easier to discern, but Gravity, Life of Pi, The Revenant, for example, beautifully shot by Chivo and nominated Oscar-wise and ASC Award-wise. And the movie, you could probably legally classify every frame in the film as an effects shot on some level or another due to the post-production handling of the film. And yet,
well,
it appears seamless. Oh, yeah, because it's so well done. It's so well done. It's seamless. It's beautiful, beautiful. Top of the work right now. I think if you're going to look at it in any sense of the cinematographer's responsibility, I think Gravity and The Revenant are both terrific examples of this type of thing, of a hybrid film, because it's very clear that the collaboration between the director and the cinematographer was so close that Chivo was empowered to govern the entire look of the film from stem to stern. Chivo was the guy whose stamp is on that film as the author of the visuals. Regardless of how many post artists and effects people worked on it, they did so under his very, very strong guidance. And that is really what it's about for a cinematographer, ultimately. I mean, these things are just tools, and they're means to an end. They're not the be-all and end-all. It's the means to an end. What is it you're trying to do? You're trying to tell a story, and you have these tools in the box, and sometimes you need other people and other technicians to help you use them. But as long as they do so under a strict guiding eye, one pair of eyes, let's say, then it's all good.
It's interesting what you said about The Revenant, because I have to go back to it now because I don't want to have any spoiler alerts, but I'll just say that obviously I thought a special effect involved an animal. And
that was beautifully done. I mean, that's plainly, you're not going to kill the guy, but plainly, I mean, that was just brilliantly done. But so is the rest of the film. Every frame of that movie had been massaged.
Yeah, so I'm thinking about what you were saying in reference to, you know, if the toolbox was now we have effects and computers and this, and we can, and what Deakins did with O Brother Art Thou, but then, you know, back to Mr. Wexler, where the toolbox would be like what the great talk we heard about Dog Day Afternoon at the clubhouse of bouncing lights off of a wall. Or just natural lighting, or, you know.
Well, those guys working back then, which is quite a while ago now, you know, they had to do it all in camera for the most part. You know, you were very, very limited in what you could do once you had exposed the negative. Certainly there were effects and there were possibilities, but nothing approaching what we do today, what we do so handily today, was very, very cumbersome to achieve then. And the mantra was always, and remains to a great extent, do it in camera. Do as much as you can in camera. I mean, I was an assistant cameraman through the 1980s, and what I remember cinematographers doing in camera, you know, say just to take down a hot patch of sky, that today you wouldn't think twice about it. You go into the DI suite, you put a power window in, and you dial it down, and in 30 seconds, it's done. Well, in those days, you couldn't do that, and you had to put it on the negative, and you'd be fiddling with pieces of neutral density gel on the front of the matte box and trying to just place it in, scotch tape it right in the right spot so you'd see it through the lens where it's getting the sky, and you know, lots of other things, but that's a very simple application. But there are so many things that had to be done at the lens. And it was cumbersome, time-consuming, and sometimes didn't really do what you wanted it to do. Whereas today, with these so many tools that we have in post, I mean, the look is really engineered today in post. You know, as much as you do at the lens and at the time of exposure, you still truly create the look in post. That's where it all really happens. Whereas in the old days, not so much. You really had to do it at the lens if you wanted a specific color. I'm sorry?
No. That's what I like the most about Coming Home. When I saw it, I had mentioned before you came on, was that that was a movie that made me feel like, and that was, of course, the film I spoke with Mr. Wexler about, was that it made me feel like exactly what the characters were supposed to feel. I didn't need anything else going on. I didn't need scenery or, you know, anything going on in the background. It was just the person and the camera. And like you were saying, there was less tools and they had to do it in camera. So to me, that was, I had said before he came on, that was like a real turning point in my life, especially with my dad being a Vietnam veteran, where I was just like, you know, what is this movie? Like, I'm so into these characters and I'm not looking at anything but the characters. I don't care what they have on. I don't care what's behind them. I don't care where they are. I'm just stuck in their emotions. And I think that's what you're saying, is the point of doing it in the camera.
Of course, but there's something else too that can't be overlooked when you talk about this, and that's that, you know, everyone associated with those films in the 1970s, everyone was working at the top of their game. You had great actors, you had great scripts. Above all, everything begins with the script. And you had terrific stories, beautifully written, great dialogue, great plots, great characters. Then the actors who made that stuff come to life, they were terrific at the top of their game. The directors, the editors, the production designers, everyone who contributed on whatever level, they were all in their moment. They all had their moment, their decade. And that, you know, there's not much anyone, any cinematographer can do with, let's say, a blank wall, you know, beige wall. There's not much you can do with it. You take a good story, though, and very often your job becomes, rather than having to make it great, your job becomes don't mess it up, because almost whatever you do will work. Those instances are very rare, and in the 70s, there were a lot of them, and the cinematographers at work at that time, they were able to seize those opportunities and take what they were doing to the next level, because they had the chance. Everything was in their favor, that if they did their job, or they just had a specific vision that they were able to execute, then it was going to go over even better than imagined.
Right. Well, that's why certain films that stick out for me were like Last Picture Show and, of course, Five Easy Pieces. You know, I went to Vancouver once, came home, got that at the library. My dad had been in the hospital, and the second the movie was about a guy that had to go to Vancouver because his dad was in the hospital, I just like turned it off. I was like, okay, this is where movies are actually just too real, and this is where they're capturing something that's just too authentic. I'm living it, so I don't need to watch it on a screen.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
That film, not being rude or crude, my favorite film was always The Graduate. And
oh yeah,
you know, that was another film that just felt so real. Just like just people, and like you said, people at the top of their game. I mean, Mike Nichols and I always pronounce it wrong. Is it Sturges, the cinematographer?
Bob Surtees. Now, yeah. Bob Surtees, ironically, was an old-time studio cameraman. I believe an Oscar winner. Had a terrific career, long, terrific career. And, you know, the work that he did on The Graduate, which was 1968, it was very contemporary. He was really, you could see his studio technique, but you could see he was evolving. He was picking it up. He kind of knew what was going on. Things were changing, and he was starting to bring a new look to things, too. I think that film also is one of the best edited films I've ever seen. It's just brilliantly cut, but that's for another time.
Oh, yeah, no, of course. I mean, that's the thing we always know with this show, that we set them for a certain time, but we all know that people who love films could talk to, like, Christmas off at night and still be like, wait, but I forgot to bring up. But, yeah, we really appreciate you joining us today.
Well, thank you.
To discuss your friend. We have about 6 minutes left, so if there's any last thing you'd like to say about Mr. Wexler before I wrap up, we'd love to hear.
Well, you know, I feel I was very lucky to get to have gotten to know him a little bit. You know, he was in your life. You encounter people, and some of them are immediately forgettable, and other people stick with you. And Haskell is one of those people who is going to stick. He was just such a unique individual. You don't meet a lot like that in life. And, as I say, I looked at him, I'm a bit beyond the point in life, I think, where it's advisable to have heroes. But if anyone I could look at as a role model or someone that I looked up to and admired for a lot of reasons, Haskell certainly fit that category. He had a spark and a charisma and a life force that was just irresistible on a certain level. Came away from a chat with him feeling changed or improved on some level. And I really appreciated that about him. And then there's his work. There's so much to learn from his work. We're starting to organize a memorial for him at the ASC sometime in the coming weeks. And, rooting through some of his work to create a reel, a tribute reel. And, you refresh yourself when you see these things that you haven't seen for a while. And you say, golly, look at that. Oh, I forgot that. Wow, look at that. And it comes rushing back and you forget, you know. Things get lost. As I said before, there's so many things. We're so busy and there's so many things vying for our attention today that quite often some really good things get lost in the shuffle. But it's nice to go back once in a while, and it's nice to know that that stuff will always be there to reference, to draw on. And, I would like that other people would be aware of it too, if we can spread that out there a little bit more. There's one other guy that I didn't mention from that era, William Fraker. And Billy Fraker was another guy who was in the same class as Haskell. You know, they were just by God in a certain way. They were people that if you're in the ASC clubhouse and you heard them, you heard the door open and you were in a different part of the house, but you heard their voice, oh, good, Billy's here. Oh, good, Haskell's here. It would give you a boost because you know that being with them, they just make you feel like $1 million.
Oh, yeah, I really appreciate you saying that. That was the one thing that I remembered most. I know I'll always remember when I met Mr. Wexler was I had kind of interrupted him and his wife walking in, and I said, I'm sorry for interrupting your time. And he looked at me and he said, no, thank you for stopping me. I liked your story.
Oh, and it was so sweet. But that was Haskell.
Yeah, and it was one of those moments where I felt like, wow, it's like, you know, Pacino saw 1 second of your play and said, that was cool how you got it. And I was just kind of like, and I talked about it for 45 minutes on the train ride home. And I think about after 20 minutes, my dad just started pretending he was listening. So it was just because it was just like, dad, he made this, he made that. And this. So, again, yeah. We appreciate that you're able to join us this morning and taking your time. And, please have a great Friday and wonderful weekend.
You too. Thank you, Paul. Talk to you soon.
Take care. Aloha.
Bye-bye.
Again, we're always thankful for our guests. We appreciate their time. We appreciate their knowledge and their friendship. Mr. Richard Crudo is a great person. Again, that was a quote I heard in a Haskell Wexler said in a documentary, and I'll close with this, where he said, a filmmaker doesn't have to be a good filmmaker or a good storyteller. He has to start out by being a good person. I'll leave you guys with that. Have a great day.
Thank you for listening to the Talking Pictures Podcast, real conversation and movie-induced inspiration.